On Saturday, March 8 at 7 p.m., join the Agnes Etherington Art Center as they bring back their popular series, Open Secret. In this third edition, the Agnes partners with New York Film Festival, Prismatic Ground, and its artistic director, Inay Prakash, for a screening of five short works by filmmakers exploring the gaps in their relationships to ancestral homelands, including the earth upon which Canada has imposed its borders. From Palestine to Algeria to Haiti to China, the faint outlines of nations dissolve beneath a vivid 16-millimeter overlay of memory and imagination. A Q&A with Prakash will follow the screenings. This event is free and takes place at the screening room. Save your spot today by visiting agnes.queensu.ca.
It is 5 p.m. and this is Today in YGK on CFRC 101.9 FM, broadcasting from Lower Carruthers Hall on Queen's Campus in Kingston, Ontario. Today in YGK is brought to you by CFRC's News Collective, Christina Laurie, Jesse Bell, Isabella Garrido, Jaya Kumar, and Abiyaz Karim. CFRC's news programming is made possible by the generous support of the Community Radio Fund of Canada under the Local Journalism Initiative, Queen's University Career Services, What'll I Wear at 732 Princess Street, and the Screening Room at screeningroomkingston.com. I'm CFRC's broadcast journalist Christina Laurie, and here are your local news headlines.
You were just telling me about your umbrella here.
Yes! So my umbrella, it says Stop the Hospital Cuts. Was developed by QP and in conjunction with O2 8 years ago. And here I stand again in front of KGH Emerge with this umbrella and my flag, and there's been no resolution. It's been a long fight, and it continues to be a fight.
Would you say it's gotten better or worse?
It's been worse. That's why the stretchers are here, you know? So it's hallway medicine now. The cuts back then, we saw hallway medicine, but not to the degree. So it's just been eroding and eroding year after year after year. And it's disheartening. And we have to ensure in this election that that changes.
Who you just heard from was Julia Lynch, a retiree with QP at a demonstration organized by QP's Ontario Council of Hospital Unions on Monday outside of Kingston General Hospital. On the eve of the provincial election, O2 QP members and supporters set up a lineup of hospital stretchers outside of Kingston General Hospital, symbolizing, quote, the crisis in Ontario's healthcare. This demonstration is taking place at hospitals across Ontario, with Northumberland, Sudbury, Belleville, Oshawa, London, Peterborough, and more municipalities seeing similar sights this week. Michael Hurley, president of QP's Ontario Council of Hospital Unions, spoke with CFRC at the demonstration.
You have the stretchers out here in front of Kingston General
yes.
Hospital. I was wondering if you could speak a bit to the symbolism there and why you've decided to demonstrate this way.
Well, the stretchers, you know, represent the 2,000 people who are on stretchers in hospital hallways on any given day in Ontario now. That's up from 850 when the current government promised to eliminate them. But we also want to talk about the fact that there's 250,000 people waiting for surgeries and that over 11,000 of those people died waiting last year. We want to talk about the 2.5 million people who don't have a family doctor and the 50,000 people who are waiting for long-term care. So those are all issues that we'd really like to see have more discussion in this election.
As you mentioned, that we do have a specific focus on overcrowding and hallway health care in today's demonstration. Are there anything you could speak a bit about the issues that lead to that and what issues those cause?
Well, the reason that we have this problem is because we have an aging and growing population, and we spend the least of any province and consequently have the fewest hospital beds and hospital numbers of hospital staff to patients of any hospital system in the world with a developed economy. And so the way people experience that is that they are turned away even though they might be acutely ill, or they'll spend days on a stretcher waiting for a bed, or their surgery will be delayed for, you know, a year, for 2 years, or, you know, in some tragic cases, people will miss an early diagnosis of cancer because they don't have access to the kind of primary care that they should have, the access to a family doctor. And so, these are all manifestations of a system which is really struggling as a result of undercapacity.
And I was wondering if you could dive a bit deeper into the specific issue of hallway healthcare.
Well, this is a really sinister development. I mean, we've closed so many hospital beds in this province. Like in Kingston, you used to have two functioning acute care hospitals. Now you've got one. You've undergone a significant reduction in the number of beds that you have available to the public over the years. But now the population is growing and it's aging. So as people age, they need more care. And where are they looked after? Often they're looked after on stretchers in the hallway. And that deprives people of any privacy or any dignity. And it also subjects them to risk from the close proximity of having people together like this means that the chance of them acquiring a hospital infection like MRSA or C. difficile is significantly higher. And because of the understaffing situation, the risk of medical error for these people and for all the patients in the hospital is significantly increased as well. Anything over 85% capacity, and you have the possibility of medical error going up significantly. And in Ontario, and in a hospital like this one, we operate significantly over 85% capacity.
Mm-hmm. And this is a constant issue, but why specifically today for this demonstration?
Well, in the context of the provincial election, we wanted to try to raise this issue and to popularize it, get people talking about it, and encouraging them to talk about their own experiences with healthcare, and demand of all the political parties that they put forward programs that would actually make some meaningful changes. And for example, like we would call for confirmed funding for a hospital like this one on a 5-year basis with a significant infusion of new money with the goal of getting people off the stretchers and off the surgical wait lists. We'd want a commitment like that from a party running for government.
Doug Allen, a senior healthcare researcher at CUPE, provided some key insights from CUPE's research that underscore the challenges facing healthcare workers and the current state of patient care.
Ford ran on a platform of ending hallway health care in 2018. We're now 1,034 beds more than when he came to power. It's an over 100% increase. Funding is the lowest across Canada for hospitals of any province. Staff-wise, we're missing about 34,000 staff compared to other provinces on a per capita basis. Because the funding is so low, we're in the first half of this fiscal year, Ontario hospitals have a revenue shortfall of about $800 million. In the case of this hospital here, KHSC, we're running $12.5 million short of funding. The government doesn't make clear funding, and the hospitals just have to muddle through. Michael, I think, mentioned that we have a need for extra beds and that we're running at very high bed occupancies. For KHSC, we need another 56 beds, staffed and beds and in operation, in order to run at a safe level. And because of all of these sorts of backups, and they end up in the emergency room, people can't move out of those beds until they move to other areas, is that fully 82% of patients who are admitted to the hospital at KHSC through the emergency room are not admitted within the target wait time of 8 hours. So, you know, big backups, frustration.
Members of the Kingston Health Coalition were also present to show their support. Co-chair of the Kingston Health Coalition, Joan Jardin, shared what response she's hoping to see from the province.
I want the Ontario government to work with the people to do what's best for people. and that is our public health care system that we fought so hard for. In fact, we shouldn't be fighting for the very basics now. We should be looking to expand and make it better. This is Ontario, Canada. If we can't have good health care in Ontario, Canada, where in the world can we? And I do not believe in the excuse of there is no money, because we've seen where money has been spent. And I would rather the money be spent on people. It's an investment in people. It helps their life, makes it better, and in fact saves money in the long run. It's the most important thing that we can do, and we should actually build on it.
The Ministry of Health did not respond to a request for comment from CFRC. That wraps up your headlines for this evening. Next up is the latest Queen's Campus news updates on Campus Corner.
Good evening, folks. I'm Abiyaz from CFRC News, and you're listening to our segment, Campus Corner, your go-to source for campus updates. We have got a packed week ahead with events that focus on Black History Month, mental health, leadership training, and professional development. Let's get into it. Kicking things off, Monday, February 3rd, marks the start of Black Histories and Future Month at Queen's. Join the Black Student Clubs Caucus and Human Rights and Equity Office for a powerful opening event at Mitchell Hall's Rose Innovation Hub from 12 p.m. to 2 p.m. This year's theme is Threads Weaving Black Joy and Experiences at Queen's, and it will also feature a panel discussion on the methods to the magic of Black Joy, plus an exciting performance by the ACSA dance troupe. You can stay afterwards for refreshments and a networking session. For more details, contact Jeremiah Marshall at jbm15@queensu.ca. For those in advising roles, there is a must-attend professional development workshop on Tuesday, February 4th. It's from 9 a.m. to 12 p.m. at McIntosh Corey Hall, room B176. This professional advanced coaching workshop will help advisors build emotional intelligence, active listening, and boundary setting skills to navigate complex and emotional student discussions. The session will include theory, case studies, and hands-on practice to improve your coaching techniques. This workshop is free, but registration is required. For more information, reach out to Joel Axel Richard at jmlr@queensu.ca. On Wednesday, February 5th, from 8:30 a.m. to 4:30 p.m., Queen's is offering an online workshop, Mental Health Leadership Certificate Program, a first-of-its-kind initiative in Canada. Developed in partnerships with Bell Canada Mental Health and Anti-Stigma Research Chair, this program equips leaders with practical strategies for fostering a psychologically healthy workplace. Participants will complete an e-learning module before the live session on February 5th, with additional coursework running until May 5th, 2025. The fee is $375, and it will be charged to your department, and cancellations within 10 business days will incur a $50 administration fee. For more details, contact Daniel Diaz at daniel.diaz@queensu.ca. That's your campus update for this week. A celebration of Black excellence, skills for navigating student advising, and a groundbreaking mental health leadership program. Whether you're looking to engage in social justice, professional growth, or workplace well-being, Queen's has it all for you this week. And that's a wrap. I'm Abiyaz from CFRC News, and you were listening to our segment, Campus Corner. Over to Isabella for Sports After.
History was made in Mobile, Alabama, as Canadian Taylor L. Gersma became the first U Sports quarterback to play in the NCAA's Senior Bowl. The 6'5" signal caller turned heads with impressive physical measurables during the week. Of all quarterbacks rated, L. Gersma was the tallest, had the largest hands, and had the longest wingspan. These physical attributes and L. Gersma's fearless play style led some to compare him to Buffalo Bills superstar quarterback Josh Allen. L. Gersma's direct draft comparison, however, is less hyperbolic. L. Gersma was compared to an infamous draft bust, quarterback Paxton Lynch. Lynch, a similarly long, lean, and deceptively athletic player, was taken by the Denver Broncos in the first round of the 2016 draft. Though Lynch's career did not pan out, some scouts are more confident that, with the right situation, Elgersma could have a good pro career. Brock Vieira, a writer with Sports Illustrated, noted that Elgersma's best fit would be with the Los Angeles Rams, where he would have time to learn behind their veteran, future Hall of Fame quarterback Matthew Stafford. Elgersma himself slyly acknowledged this connection during his media day interviews, noting that he, quote, likes to watch how Stafford operates. Vieira added that he feels Elgersma has 6th or 7th round potential and that he would be, quote, a great project for LA. The Rams would be the ideal situation for Elgersma, but there is no shortage of quarterback-hungry teams in this year's NFL draft. Other teams that may take a flyer on the London-born quarterback include the New Orleans Saints, the Cleveland Browns, and the Pittsburgh Steelers. Elgersma's performance during the Senior Bowl has only added fuel to these draft flames. He connected on a beautiful 43-yard pass in the second half that was equal parts power and finesse. We do not know if Taylor Elgersma will be selected in the NFL draft. No matter what happens in April, however, he has broken new ground for Canadian football and blazed an unlikely trail from U Sports to the apex of professional football. This is Jesse Bell with the Environment Canada Weather Report for the Kingston region. Wednesday, February 5th, see a daytime high of minus 3 with a 40% chance of flurries, staying steady at minus 3 overnight with a 60% chance of snow. Thursday, February 6th, we'll see a daytime high of 1 degree with a 60% chance of snow throughout the day, dropping down to minus 8 overnight. Friday, February 7th, daytime high of minus 5, mix of sun and cloud and a 30% chance of flurries. Saturday, February 8th, going to be a little bit colder with a daytime high of minus 5, but an overnight low of minus 14. Sunday, February 9th, we're going to see slightly warmer weather, daytime high of minus 1, overnight low of minus 9, with a 60% chance of snow flurries. And Monday, February 10th, we are going to see a daytime high of minus 3, a mix of sun and cloud during the day, and it's going to drop down to minus 12 overnight. This is Jesse Bell with the City of Kingston Traffic Report for the week of Monday, February 3rd, 2025. We begin with the road closures. Aberdeen Street, William DeJohnson is closed to accommodate construction activity and staging. Princess to 486 Albert is closed to accommodate construction activity and staging at 484 Albert Street. Avenue Road, McMahon to 283 Avenue is closed February 3rd at 7 a.m. to February 17th at 7 p.m. for a service connection replacement. Earl to Aberdeen and Division closed February 3rd to 10th to support construction activity. Frontenac Street, Brock to Johnson is closed February 4th and 5th from 7 a.m. to 7 p.m. each day for the replacement of a service connection. King Street, Young to Sir John A. McDonald is closed February 6th from 6 a.m. to 11 p.m. for filming at Kingston Penitentiary. If a weather event occurs February 6th, the closure will take place from February 7th from 6 a.m. to 11 p.m. Again, that's only if a weather event occurs to delay filming. Market Street, King to Ontario, closed January 27th to February 21st for the Spirit of Winter. Queen Street, Division to Clergy, closed until February 7th for the demolition of 283 Queen Street. Here are some other delays to be aware of. Front Road, Sand Bay to Country Club, expect delays for the installation of sanitary and water main for Utilities Kingston. Traffic will be reduced to one lane in each direction. Please be aware of lane shifts, traffic speed limits, and share the lane signage. Highway 2, Abbeydon to St. Lawrence. Expect delays to complete enhanced flood protection of Abbeydon Road, Highway 2, and St. Lawrence Avenue.
Hello, I'm Henry Walker, CFRC intern from the Queen's Department of History. Here's today's concert and events calendar. Starting with concerts, on Wednesday, Hotel Wolf Island will have Mike Rapkins hosting their free weekly open mic night from 8:30 to 11:30. Tiernanod will also be hosting their free open mic night with host Logan Brown starting at 7. On Thursday, Toronto band The Sadies and Kingston alt folk rock musician Evan Jackson will be performing at the Broom Factory at 7:30 with tickets available online for $30. The instrumental jazz and Latin group Clear Breeze will be performing a free show at Hotel Wolf Island from 6 to 9 p.m. And on Thursday, the John McLurg Band is going to be playing at the RCHA Club starting at 7 p.m. with a $5 cover charge. On Friday, Grammy Award-winning jazz musician Branford Marsalis will be playing with his quartet at the Isabel from 7:30 to 9. Tickets are available online for $92. Busty and the Bass, alongside Zach Zoya, will be performing at the Broom Factory at 7:30 with tickets going for just over $25. Also, the Toucan's going to have the Gertrudes playing from 5 to 8 p.m. at a free gig on Friday. On Saturday, the group Heatwave will be playing a collection of hits from The Supremes, Stevie Wonder, and many more from 8 to 11 p.m. at the RCHA Club, cover fee of $25. Tiernanog has the band Three Pistols booked for a free gig from 9 to 12, and the groups Potions and Poplar will be playing from 8:30 to 11 p.m. at Hotel Wolf Island. On Sunday, the Kingston Symphony will be performing from 2:30 to 4 at the Isabel, with tickets ranging from $20 to $50. And finally, local Kingston singer-songwriter Jonathan Jones will be performing at Spearhead Brewery from 2 to 5 p.m. Have a concert you would like to add to our online and on-air concert calendar? Reach out today via cfrc.ca or at cfrcmusic on Instagram using the link tree in our bio. Once again, this is Henry, CFRC intern from the Department of History, continuing with this week's events calendar. On Wednesday, the Grad Club will be hosting the Open Stage Drag Show starting at 8 p.m. Those interested in performing should arrive before 7:45 or during intermission around 9 p.m. Performance slots are first come, first serve. The Mansion will also be hosting karaoke starting at 9. Also on Wednesday, both Something in the Water and Daft Brewing will be hosting their trivia nights starting at 7 p.m. On Thursday, Big Ticket, a new play by Jim Gerard, opens at the Grand Theater with tickets available online for roughly $33. Performances will continue up until the 23rd. Also, the Kingston Public Market is open from 8:30 to 4 p.m. at Springer Market Square. On Friday, both Daft Brewing and The Buckle will be hosting karaoke night starting at 9 p.m. Also, the City of Kingston's Spirit of Winter Festival continues at Springer Market Square with festivities starting for the 7th day in a row at 6 p.m. On Saturday, the Kingston Public Market runs at Springer Market Square starting at 8:30 a.m. Also on Saturday, a Valentine's pop-up market is going to take place at the Tet Center from 10:30 a.m. onwards. And on Sunday, the Memorial Center Farmers Market is taking place starting at 9 a.m. An oil paint techniques four scene workshop is taking place at 370 Keene Street, also at 9. And finally, the Toucan will be hosting karaoke starting at 10:30. Have an event you would like to add to our online and on-air event calendar? Reach out today via cfrc.ca or at cfrcmusic on Instagram using the link tree in our bio.
Thank you for tuning in to CFRC's local news programming. To revisit episodes of Today in YGK and hear more from some of our guests, be sure to head to our podcast network at podcast.cfrc.ca. Today in YGK is brought to you by the generous support of the Community Radio Fund of Canada under the Local Journalism Initiative, Queen's University Career Services, What Will I Wear, 732 Princess Street, and The Screening Room at screeningroomkingston.com. Be sure to stay tuned for more CFRC programming coming up next.
What'll I Wear offers the best in vintage, funky, one-of-a-kind treasures, clothing, accessories, and a fabulous selection of jewels, vintage and new. Find the cutest purse, the most dashing of hats and sunglasses, everything to complete your individual look. What'll I Wear has it all. They can dress you from top to bottom. Find your new fashion fave at What'll I Wear at 732 Princess Street in Kingston. Visit their new location and follow them on Facebook to keep up to date with what's in store at What'll I Wear. Coming up now on this week's Release Radar, in partnership with the Kingston Music Office, we're pleased to present a new single by the Sugar Pills called Sugar Pill. The latest track gives listeners a window into a night out in Kingston with the band. It speaks to making your own fun regardless of time or place. Sugar Pill has that quintessential feel-good factor, leaving you with an optimistic glow. Want to be highlighted next time? Complete the Release Radar submission form on the Kingston Music Office website or via visit kingston.music on Instagram. In the meantime, stream Sugar Pill by the Sugar Pills on your favorite platforms and enjoy it here with us now on CFRC 101.9 FM. ¶¶
coasters. They say us outside, admiring our poster. Evan's waiting on a drink he ordered 20 minutes ago. An old guy just offered me a beer, but I know if I take it, I'll have to stay here. And all of this has got me wondering if I should have gone home.
Bruce Kuwabara celebrated Canadian architect and the mind behind Agnes Reimagined, the new home of the Agnes Etherington Art Center, is this year's Francis K. Smith Lecturer in Canadian Art. In his talk, Catalyzing Change, Kuwabara presents several recent projects that explore the themes of art and community and the insights he gained working on Agnes Reimagined. Join us on Thursday, March 20th at 6 p.m. in Grant Hall for this exciting event. Tickets are free, but please register by visiting agnes.queensu.ca.
K-8 KPP Concerts and CFRC 101.9 FM present a stacked lineup of shows this January and February at the Broom Factory, featuring a mix of big-name acts and some local favorites. On January 18th, don't miss Canadian alt-rock duo Mountain Head. January 24th features local indie rock outfit Cassador. On January 26th, Bedouin Soundclash takes the stage. February 7th sees Busty and the Bass come to town. And on February 19th, it's a special Wednesday night rock show with headliners Dear Rouge. For additional information and to buy tickets, visit kppconcerts.com.
Those of us who have been working in this space for a long time, we had an idea that we would get some sort of a massive assault on riots. And I actually, in the immediate aftermath of the election, for those of you who do read my newsletter, the very next day I published here are the steps that you need to take right now. I think that this is an issue of exhaustion. That is part of why we have seen this blitz of executive orders. It's designed to scare. It's designed to make you feel exhausted. It's designed to make you feel powerless.
Welcome to This Way Out, the international LGBTQ radio magazine. I'm Brian DeShazer. Australia reviews gender-affirming healthcare for kids. Donald Trump attacks trans medical and military rights. And journalist Aaron Reed dissects Trump's executive order blitz. Those stories and more this week, now that you've discovered This Way Out.
I'm Tanya Kane Perry.
And I'm Joe Bainline.
With NewsWrap, a summary of some of the news in or affecting LGBTQ communities around the world for the week ending February 1st, 2025. Gender-affirming healthcare for Australia's trans and gender-diverse young people is under review. The National Health and Medical Research Council will conduct the study, which will include the efficacy of hormone treatments and puberty blockers. Queensland's January 29th announcement of its own review moved the federal government to take action 2 days later. The state plans to pause access to all gender-affirming health care for new patients under the age of 18. Australian Health Minister Mark Butler urged Queensland officials to yield to the federal review and allow treatment to continue for the state's current young trans patients pending those results. He wants treatment guidelines to be nationally consistent. Butler says the committee of experts conducting the review will look at treatment guidelines in other countries. It will include public consultation and, importantly, the lived experiences of young trans and gender diverse patients. An interim report on the specific use of puberty blockers for young people with gender dysphoria is expected by the middle of 2026. There are no time projections for reports regarding other forms of pediatric gender affirming care. The antagonistic grassroots Australian Christian lobby is urging the government to ensure that the review is truly independent, free from activist influence, and grounded in medical evidence, not ideology. Meanwhile, most LGBTQ advocacy groups are cautiously optimistic about the national review. Equality Australia vows its participation in the process and urges Queensland officials to abandon their temporary pause so pediatric gender-affirming care continues to be delivered to patients across the country. CEO Anna Brown said, "Politicians should not be in the business of making medical decisions for young people and families they have never met and whose experience of life are unimaginable to most of them." Transcend Australia CEO Jeremy Wiggins expressed the fears of parents in his organization about the review, but hopes if this federal process remains ethical, draws on evidence, and the right people, including those with lived experience, we are confident the outcome will be positive for trans children and young people.
U.S. President Donald Trump has blood on his hands, in the words of Advocates for Trans Equality Executive Director Rodrigo Heng Leitinen. Trump's latest and perhaps most egregious anti-transgender executive order restricts gender-affirming health care for people under the age of 19. Heng Leitinen warns this executive order not only prohibits, but sets the stage for criminalizing medically necessary gender-affirming care, endangering tens of thousands of transgender adolescents. The fallacy-ridden screed reads in part, "It is the policy of the United States that it will not fund, sponsor, promote, assist, or support the so-called transition of a child from one sex to another, and it will rigorously enforce all laws that prohibit or limit these destructive and life-altering procedures." The ban includes hormone therapies and puberty blockers, both of which are reversible. It prohibits pediatric gender-affirming surgery, which is rarely a recommended treatment option. The order halts funding through federally run insurance programs such as Medicaid and the military families TRICARE. LGBTQ policy analysts from the Williams Institute at UCLA issued a brief saying that Trump's order requires further administrative rulemaking, therefore it will not take effect immediately. Like many of Trump's shock and awe flurry of edicts, the legality of his ban on gender-affirming care for young people will almost certainly be challenged in court.
One Trump executive order is already on its way to court. The Human Rights Campaign and Lambda Legal are taking on the new ban on service in the U.S. military by transgender and gender-diverse enlistees. The same two national queer rights groups successfully blocked the first Trump administration's attempted military service ban in the 2017 Karnofsky v. Trump case. Trump reversed a Biden administration order that had opened service to qualified trans people, then specifically excluded them with another. It affects new recruits, but it could also impact currently serving trans and gender diverse personnel. In the words of Lambda legal counsel Sasha Burkett, "Thousands of current service members are transgender, and many have been serving openly, courageously, and successfully in the U.S. military for more than 8 years." HRC Vice President of Legal Sarah Warbelow says the order insults their service and puts our national security at risk.
The United States Supreme Court has agreed to hear tales of a family attending an LGBTQ pride event, a girl meeting her uncle's husband-to-be, and a prince's love for a knight as they battle a dragon together. A group of parents in Montgomery County, Maryland, want the right to pull their children from elementary school classes that include such storybooks. They claim that their religious beliefs are being violated if they cannot shield their kids from LGBTQ content. They've already lost in an appeals court. Lawyers for the Washington, D.C. suburb school system had asked the high court to reject the case. They argued that the storybooks being challenged touch on themes of adventure, confronting new emotions, and making oneself heard, just like the classics Snow White, Cinderella, and Peter Pan. The district wrote, "Parents who chose to send their children to public schools are not deprived of their right to freely exercise their religion, simply because their children are exposed to curricular material the parents find offensive." The parents are being represented by Eric Baxter, senior counsel at the Beckett Fund for Religious Liberty. He insists that the school district is cramming down controversial gender ideology on three-year-olds. It's unclear if the Supreme Court will hear arguments in the case before its new term begins in October, according to the Associated Press.
Minneapolis, Minnesota's Twin Cities Pride is parting ways with one of its biggest business sponsors, but it certainly won't be sorry. The organization broke up with Target Stores in response to the Minneapolis-based giant retailer's announcement that it would end or scale back programs that promote diversity in the workforce and corporate culture. While it has scored high marks for inclusivity in the past, it's now ending its participation in the Human Rights Campaign's annual Corporate Equality Index. Far-right social media zealot Robbie Starbuck was targeting Target for potential consumer boycotts against corporate DEI, diversity, equity, and inclusion. More than a dozen major companies have bowed to those threats. Executive Director Andy Otto told the Minnesota Star Tribune that Twin Cities Pride would reject Target's expected $50,000 to $70,000 sponsorship this year to protest the company's surrender. As he told the Star Tribune, unfortunately, in a time when it's been a really, really rough week for our community, given everything that has come down from the new Trump administration, this was kind of the straw that broke the camel's back. That proud gesture did not go unrewarded. Donations from the community made up for the Target sponsorship in less than 24 hours and doubled it within a few days.
Finally, the day before rival Target stores joined the trend of corporations abandoning DEI programs, voters representing 98% of Costco shareholders rejected a bid to dump its inclusivity initiatives. The defeated proposal was sponsored by the Robbie Starbuck Allied National Center for Public Policy Research. Costco's board of directors had vigorously defended the company's DEI policies, proud to proclaim that inclusion is central to their successful business model. The consulting firm Global Data predicted the vote ahead of the stockholders' meeting. Its retail division managing director Neil Saunders said, "I think people generally have confidence in Costco's management, and there's an attitude of, why rock the boat? It's sailing very nicely." Costco CEO Ron Vacris praised the overwhelming support of our shareholders. Starbuck lamented the vote in a social media post, saying that, "For now, I suggest conservative consumers find other places to spend their money." He probably shops at Target.
That's News Wrap, global queer news with attitude for the week ending February 1st, 2025. Follow the news in your area and around the world. An informed community is a strong community.
News Wrap is written by Greg Gordon and Lucia Chappell, produced by Brian DeShazer, brought to you by you.
Thank you. Help keep us in ears around the world at thiswayout.org, where you can also read the text of this newscast and much more. For This Way Out, I'm Tanya Kane Perry. Stay healthy.
And I'm Joe Bainline. Stay safe.
Our listeners support This Way Out in many ways.
By subscribing to our e-newsletter.
Email us at info@thiswayout.org.
And through your financial contributions to our program.
More information about how you can give is online at thiswayout.org.
Thank you.
Look what they done to my song. Turning out all wrong, Ma. Look what they done to my song.
There's a target on the back of every transgender person in the U.S., and the public policy weapons are in the hands of the MAGA Republicans. The war is personal for transgender journalist Erin Reed. She's a respected independent voice with a large following on social media, earning more than 250 million views in recent years. Reed met last week with a group of trans people and allies to review the growing list of anti-trans executive orders coming out of the Trump White House. This Way Out's David Hunt covered the correspondents' conversation.
First came a presidential order defining gender in the simplest terms.
I made it the official policy of the United States government that there are only two genders, male and female. Gee, that was a tough one.
That executive order, signed on Inauguration Day by President Donald Trump, was quickly followed by two more assailing the rights of transgender Americans. One lays the groundwork for banning transgender people from serving in the United States military. The other attempts to outlaw gender-affirming health care for young people nationwide. These, among hundreds of executive orders of debatable constitutionality, came in rapid-fire succession, leaving reporters scrambling to cover the story, to predict the impact of the measures, and, as always with Trump, to separate fact from fiction. I'm David Hunt. In the news business, when a reporter dominates coverage of an issue or event, tapping the best sources and providing the most insightful analysis, we say they own the story. If anyone owns the story of the rights assault on transgender Americans, it's Aaron Reed.
I don't think many of us asked to be on the vanguard of this, but here we are. We're here. And we are building a world where future generations, I hope to God, don't have to fight this same fight. And as much as all the sound and fury from the top of the Oval Office is sort of raining down upon us, there are more people like me than ever before that are public, that are themselves.
Reed isn't just one of a small group of queer journalists covering national politics. She's one of an even smaller subset of transgender journalists. As such, she's covering the political assault on her own rights, even her own existence, and providing that coverage in great detail and with great accuracy, employing a veteran reporter's unflinching scrutiny. In a line-by-line analysis of Trump's order banning trans people in the military, she wrote, "This marks a chilling and undeniable shift. The attacks on transgender people are no longer cloaked in the faux respectability of evidence, science, or protecting kids. They never truly were, but now even the pretense has been abandoned." Her daily reporting can be read on Substack, a subscription-based platform for independent journalists. Find her at erininthemorning.com, with Erin spelled E-R-I-N. On January 30th, Reed met with about 100 trans people and their allies on a Zoom call sponsored by the trans-led nonprofit GRACE, Gender Research Advisory Council and Education. What started as a review of anti-trans legislation soon turned into a strategy session and pep talk with GRACE board member Kathy Brennan.
Okay, Erin, can you unmute yourself?
Yes, hello. Hi, everybody. How's it going?
Yeah, there you are.
Wished it were better circumstances, but I'm here tonight to speak with all of you. And look forward to talking. You know, I've been doing this work for a long time, and I think that there are very few people who have the history that I do in terms of like reading the stuff at the beginning. I was there whenever all of this current wave started. You know, whenever you talk about 5 years ago, if you would time travel somebody from 5 years ago to today, it would be unrecognizable. The debate over transgender people and our care and our existence and more. If all of you will probably remember 5 years ago, the biggest thing back then around trans people were a smattering of states that had sports bans, and that was it. There was one bathroom ban in 2016 in North Carolina, and that was a disaster. The PayPal pulled out of the state. Deutsche Bank pulled out of the state. They lost $3.7 billion in revenue because of that bathroom ban. But what happened after that was the same organizations that have become very popular, famous now, infamous now, you know, your Alliance Defending Freedom, your Project 2025, groups like the Heritage Foundation and more, they held a conference in 2017 in Phoenix, Arizona, and they planned out their strategy for what we're seeing now. And they executed that strategy over time. Architects of the plan from the American Principles Project, Terry Schilling, had specifically said that they were going to start with sports so that way they could get people comfortable with discriminating. And then after they got you with sports, they were going to go to kids, and then they were going to go to bathrooms, and then they were going to continue growing on that more and more and more. And like he sort of James Bond monologued this to CNN in early 2020. And we're seeing exactly that. Like the strategy has happened exactly as he had planned it. And the same groups that, you know, were part of that conference are now the ones that are writing the Trump executive order.
So where do we start now, right? Like it's, it's kind of a really tough situation, but now we have all these executive orders. So the first one being about the military, and then about government ID. So access, you know, government ID, your ID is your access to everything in this country and the world, you know, like your driver's license, your social security card, your all of it. Like, so it's, you know, access And if you don't have access, you don't have anything else.
Those of us who have been working in this space for a long time, we had an idea that we would get some sort of a blitz, some sort of a massive assault on riots. And I actually, in the immediate aftermath of the election, for those of you who do read my newsletter, the very next day I published a, here are the steps that you need to take right now. And at the very top of that list was go get your passport renewed right now. Get it renewed right now. And thankfully, I was able to reach a large number of the community. I'd built up quite a large readership, a large following, large viewership on various social media video platforms like TikTok and Instagram, where I blasted this message out there because I knew that one of the first dominoes to fall would be passports. And in fact, the very first day of the Trump presidency, we got an executive order that erased legal recognition of transgender people throughout the government. So in every single aspect of the way that the executive branch handles trans people. So we're talking non-discrimination protections. Are they going to, for instance, file a claim of non-discrimination if I get denied housing, you know, because I'm trans, because a particular landlord doesn't like that, doesn't want a trans person moving into the neighborhood? Am I going to be discriminated against in education because, you know, a public university decides that trans people go against their mission? And you know, typically, no, you're not supposed to be able to discriminate against people like that. But this administration has stated that it will refuse that legal recognition. And the top of that, the most impactful of that, was in passports, because many people that were in the process of getting their passports have had them held up right now.
You're listening to This Way Out, the international LGBTQ radio magazine. I'm David Hunt. Much of Aaron Reed's work as a journalist focuses on providing context to the onslaught of anti-trans measures flooding the zone with shit, in the words of Trump strategist Steve Bannon. She said the culture war attacks don't represent the lived experiences of many trans and LGBTQ people.
With all of the bad laws and all of the harmful things that they're doing at that level, on our legal documents and more, on a personal level, I've never felt more support in my entire life. Like, I've got more support than I ever have. I myself in public every single day. I never get a second look. People talk to me about, you know, the things that I care about. I am a productive member of society. I am here. I have friends. And I think that part of the reason why they're making such a push through laws is because they know that the people that you live with in your community, that hate is not there. It's not, they want you to believe that it's so much more present. I think that this is an issue of exhaustion. And I think that that is part of why we have seen this blitz of executive orders. It's designed to scare. It's designed to make you feel exhausted. It's designed to make you feel powerless.
In a news analysis on her site, Reed explained how Trump's executive order defining gender could fundamentally reshape how laws, policies, and regulations are applied throughout federal agencies. The practical implications are enormous, she wrote. These definitions form the foundation of the rest of the executive orders, serving as a directive for every federal agency to reinterpret and enforce their policies through this narrow and reductive lens. For instance, the Department of Education could use this definition to exclude transgender women from Title IX protections, federal protections from sex discrimination enacted in 1972. In an analysis of the executive order banning gender-affirming care, Reed said the measure explicitly weaponizes the Department of Justice against transgender youth, their families, and their medical providers. The order defines gender-affirming care as mutilation and then exploits that definition to claim that female genital mutilation laws apply to transgender care. The executive order wields every available lever of power, and even some Trump may not legally control, Reed reported. If there's such a thing as a trans power couple, it's Reed and her wife, Zoe Zephyr, the first trans woman elected to the Montana legislature. The couple tied the knot last December in a ceremony at the Missoula County Fairgrounds in Montana, a moment that was, in Reed's words, perfect in every way.
I saw fireworks that day. I saw fireworks for the second time in 2 days.
In April 2023, Zephyr was barred from her seat on the floor of the Montana House of Representatives after she shamed the Republican majority for voting to outlaw gender-affirming care for young people. She spent the remainder of the legislative session working from a bench in the House lobby, a bench her supporters took turns occupying on her behalf after Republicans tried to deny her even that place to sit down. The GOP's petty tactics may have alienated some of their supporters, Reed explained.
You know, we drove to Glacier National Park, beautiful national park, and we pulled up to the side, and then this big F-250 pulled up behind us. And out came three burly men in camo. They walked up to us, and one of them looked to her and said, "Are you Zoe Zephyr?" And Zoe's like, yeah, that's me. Hi.
Wow.
And he said, "Well, I'm a Republican." It's like, we can guess, but that's okay. I'm a Republican. But then he said, "But I want to let you know I would sit on that seat for you." And he just... he had such a visceral response to the idea that, like, she is a democratically elected person who is being silenced just for speaking words, just for saying her mind.
Reed advised the trans people and their supporters on the Zoom call to focus on the things they can accomplish, the connections they can make, even in difficult times.
Don't let yourself burn out. Have something that has an endpoint. Find your local community. That's how we got through Stonewall. I mean, that's how we got through that period, is that we had our gay straight alliances and our queer family groups, our church groups and more. And I think that, you know, whatever that looks like for you, help foster those connections, because that will help people stay here while we're dealing with all this.
I'd like to thank GRACE Executive Director Elena Kupek, Board Member Kathy Brennan, and journalist Aaron Reed for organizing this discussion of the assault on transgender rights by the Trump administration. Find links to their websites at thiswayout.org. For This Way Out, I'm David Hunt.
To the river we go, leave our worries on the shore and drift away on the river we know, sometimes the perfect words are never said.
Thanks for finding This Way Out, brought to you by the nonprofit Overnight Productions. NewsWrap was reported this week by Tanya Kane Perry and Joe Bainline, and produced by Brian DeShazer. David Hunt produced this week's Aaron Reed feature, with thanks to Kathy Brennan and GRACE, Gender Research Advisory Council and Education. The Beatles, Melanie Safka, and Michael Shines performed some of the music you heard, and Kim Wilson composed and performed our theme music. This Way Out thanks Lee Sloan of Albuquerque, New Mexico, and Richard Merck and Brad Payton of Silicon Valley. Listener donors make this program possible. Ask us about how you can join them. Look for This Way Out Radio on social media, email us at info@thiswayout.org, or write us at P.O. Box 1065, Los Angeles, California, 90078, USA. For coordinating producer Greg Gordon, associate producer Lucia Chappelle, and all of us at This Way Out, I'm Brian DeShazer. Thanks for listening. Online at thiswayout.org or wherever you get your podcasts, on CFMH, St. John, New Brunswick, KYAQ, Newport, Lincoln County, Oregon, WORT, Madison, Wisconsin, and a wide array of community terrestrial and internet radio stations around the world, including this one. Stay safe, stay healthy, and stay tuned.
Hey, CFRC listeners. In celebration of International Women's Day, local icon Miss Emily and the Kingston Music Office are hosting an International Women's Day showcase on March 7th at the Broom Factory. With support from your